Hello, my name is Cheryl Cohen, and I'm the president of Arthritis Consumer Experts, or ACE. ACE provides education and training to people with arthritis. We also help to empower people living with all forms of arthritis to take control of their disease and to take action in healthcare and research decision making. I'm also a person living with rheumatoid arthritis. ACE is excited to bring you its Joint Health Podcast Series, the first arthritis education podcast program ever to launch in Canada. Four Joint Health Podcast programs are being made available in September, Arthritis Month in Canada. Each program will provide the listener with evidence-based arthritis information on topics ranging from arthritis research to effective and safe exercise for people living with arthritis. Joint Health Podcasts will feature a different topic each week presented by a leading Canadian rheumatologist and arthritis patient advocate. The first in this series of Joint Health Podcasts is with Dr. John Esdale. This podcast will be made available on September 7th and will feature the topic of advancements in arthritis research. The following week, we'll be joined by Dr. Kamran Shojania. On September 14th, we'll discuss with him the treatment advances in inflammatory arthritis. On September 21st, we'll be speaking with Dr. Linda Lee on a topic that is very familiar to her, exercise and arthritis. And the last of the four podcast programs will feature Dr. Deanne Lakai. On September 28th, we'll be speaking with her about arthritis and work. As I mentioned, the first program in our Joint Health Podcast series is on advancements in arthritis research with Dr. John Esdale, and I'm really pleased to be speaking with Dr. Esdale today. Dr. Esdale is the professor and head of the Division of Rheumatology at the Department of Medicine at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, British Columbia. Dr. Esdale is also the scientific director of the Arthritis Research Center of Canada and is an internationally respected rheumatologist who spearheaded the creation of the Arthritis Research Center of Canada. We are going to be talking about a variety of topics under the main heading of advancements in arthritis research. But first, I'd like to welcome Dr. Esdale to the program.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Dr. Esdale, this program really is intended to provide the person with arthritis and also the public listener with an overview of arthritis research, including some of the following topics, such as what arthritis research is and who benefits from it, where arthritis research is actually conducted, because I think the public generally doesn't know where research is conducted in terms of health, and also aspects of arthritis research funding. Who actually funds research? How do researchers go about getting funds? And myriad other topics. So I thought maybe where we would start, if it's all right with you, is I'd like to ask you to define the term research. What is, or more specifically, health research in the area of arthritis? What is it?
Well, I think research is quite simply trying to answer questions, that all research is driven by a question. What's the cause of this disease? What do these laboratory tests mean? Does this medication really work for this condition? Those are all questions that you or I might have, and the researcher's job is to answer those questions. There are different levels of science. It can be done in a preliminary manner, and it can be done in a much more detailed and perhaps definitive manner. But the game is to answer questions about arthritis so that we better understand it, can take better care of people with it, can prevent it.
That makes lots of sense. I think the public in general views research, or the term research, as sort of a big black box. So you help to define the term and what it is. Who does research? Where is it being done? Is it being done in universities, but perhaps also in hospital settings, out in the community? Maybe you can...
Research is really done in so many different places. You've mentioned universities, which is a site for a great deal of research, but you also mentioned hospitals, that many teaching hospitals are very involved in research. Physicians in private offices, there are companies making drugs, but also new young companies making very novel biologic agents that are performing research. There are really two main big areas of research. One is fundamental or basic research. In this setting, the scientist is perhaps trying to understand a mechanism, a molecule that's been found in a disease. They don't even know that it's really key or plays an important role. They're trying to find things that will perhaps 20 years down the road become the key piece that leads to a cure or absolute prevention of a disease. At the opposite end of the spectrum are people who are trying to find out, how do we treat my patient today in the best possible way so that they can live a better life? There you're perhaps studying drugs or interventions that will really improve quality of life for people with arthritis. In between, there's a huge spectrum of people doing perhaps studying things such as genes or tests in the individual patient.
And so I presume the first part of what you described is the types of research, the basic end. Then that involves labs and rats and petri dishes and things like that. And as you say, at the other end of the spectrum, people. So that's what we would hear at the public level as health services research, perhaps?
No, because there's therapy research, which is not health services. Mm. Health services is looking at how healthcare is delivered to people, so how the delivery process itself, and the research on that will be trying to understand how one can deliver perhaps something like joint replacement surgery more efficiently.
I understand. Thanks. In terms of the latest research developments, so we sort of now know what research is and we know where it's going on. Who's funding it, and how do we hear about those developments? It seems like it's tough. What we read about, it's always a push me, pull me. You hear about advances, and then in the next breath they say, but we really don't know for sure yet. So can you describe who funds it and how we would go about learning more about arthritis research going on?
There are several questions there. First of all, who funds it? The funding sources for arthritis research and research in general are quite varied. The Canadian Institutes of Health Research is a federally funded group that is the largest funding body in the country, and they fund not only arthritis research, but all medical research touching on the social sciences, clinical medicine, and very basic research as well. Many provinces have research funding groups. Quebec, Alberta, British Columbia are good examples of provinces that provide some funding, often towards supporting the salaries of research scientists. Then there are groups such as the pharmaceutical industry that may be doing research on new drugs in-house, but are also involved in testing drugs across the country in doctors' offices or hospitals. And they will provide funding to study their particular new drugs. Finally, there are small pools of money that have been set aside or individual donors who step up to the plate to fund perhaps a specific project, so that there are a great many diverse sources, and the research scientist is often dealing with all of those sources in order to find the funds to perform research. How much money goes towards arthritis research is another question you suggested, and the answer is, of course, too little. About 1 in 10 people who visit a family doctor are going there for some problem of their musculoskeletal system. It may be a very severe arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis. It may be osteoarthritis. It may be back disease. It may be trauma. It may be thin bones or osteoporosis. Although 1 in 10 people are seeing their family doctor for this, only 1 or 2% of research money goes towards arthritis. What this means is there's a real gap between the burden of arthritis and the money committed to improving the lives of people with arthritis and preventing arthritis. It also means there aren't people being trained to do arthritis research because there's no money there when they finish to be a researcher.
How many, that raises a question in my mind, how many researchers are there in the area of arthritis? Is that a, do you know the answer to that, or does anyone know the answer to that? I gather some probably research across a variety of disease spectrums. And how many rheumatologists are there? And are they the same thing? Are researchers rheumatologists and vice versa?
Rheumatologists are physicians who've had special training in arthritis. They've had a minimum of 2 years of training focusing solely on the clinical diagnosis and management of people with arthritis. There are about 300 arthritis specialists or rheumatologists in the country. Rheumatologists don't do surgery like orthopedic surgeons, focus only on the medical aspects of treatment and diagnosis. Many of these are, of course, involved in teaching, so that the full number of practicing rheumatologists would be less than that 300.
Wow, that's incredible given the prevalence of the disease. I understand that roughly 1 in 5 Canadians has some form of arthritis.
Well, certainly most people with arthritis are not going to get to see a rheumatologist. It's just not possible, even if it might be beneficial for many of them. You also asked, how many researchers are there in Canada working on arthritis? That's a harder number to come up with. However, the Canadian Arthritis Network brings together arthritis scientists from across the country. This is funded by the federal government and has been going on for about 8 years now. It has about 140 members. Now, not all of these people are full-time researchers. Many may be rheumatologists who are seeing patients many days a week, but devoting a little time towards supporting research projects or other research endeavors, perhaps at a university or hospital. Nonetheless, it's a reasonable number to keep in mind, somewhere around 140 or perhaps a little less.
Still, as you say, far too few given the prevalence and also that given the fact that there are no known cures for the over 100 different types of arthritis disease.
Well, it's fascinating. If you summed up all of the money that goes into arthritis research in Canada from federal governments, provincial governments, and all of that, it would certainly be considerably less than $20 million and might be as low as $10 million. The cost of arthritis care and musculoskeletal disease in Canada is probably well over $10 billion. So very little money is being put back into research that might actually reduce the costs of these very common diseases.
Right. So obviously, it goes without saying, in your world, the lack of resources is having a tremendous impact in making advances, perhaps as quickly as certainly people with arthritis would like to see you make them.
I think that's true for people with arthritis, and I think it's true for the government. I think more money spent on research would save huge sums of money in the near term and the long term. One has to keep in mind that while people without arthritis think that arthritis is a single condition, there are in fact 100 different types of arthritis, so that research on one does not always carry over totally to applicable results in many of the other types.
That's fascinating. When we talk about lack of resources much badly needed resources to make these advancements. Nevertheless, advancements have been made over the last number of years. And I'm wondering if you could touch on sort of maybe some of the banner big headings of arthritis. If there are over 100, obviously we're not going to be able to talk about all of those in 30 minutes. But perhaps if you could focus first on osteoarthritis, which is the most common form of arthritis. More Canadians suffer from it than any other type of arthritis. So maybe we'll use that as an entry point into the discussion around what we have learned with the money that has been spent in arthritis research lately.
You're quite right about the frequency of osteoarthritis. This is the form of arthritis where the gristle or cartilage at the end of the bones is permanently damaged. It affects things such as knees and hips and hands and back. It's the cause or the disorder that results in the greatest need for hip replacements and knee replacement surgery. It was for very many years a black box, very hard to do research on, very hard for the basic scientists to obtain tissue to study at an early enough phase to really make a difference. Canada has been a leader in osteoarthritis research. Robin Poole at the Shriners, groups in Toronto, Jean-Pierre Pelletier in Montreal, a number of scientists across the country 20 years ago started to perform research to help us understand how the body was damaging the cartilage. That's, I think, starting to pay off, and one can envisage that this very basic work done over the past two decades is going to lead to novel treatments, probably within a decade, that may actually prevent or slow down the progress of the cartilage damage. Other work that's ongoing right now, and in which, again, Canada is a leader, is looking for blood tests that could say, yes, you have early osteoarthritis. Right now, when a physician in their office diagnoses osteoarthritis of the knee, it's been present for a long time, and there's already a lot of damage. There's a need to focus on diagnosing it early so that when these treatments become available, we can really alter the course of the disease.
Well, that sounds promising from a patient perspective. As a person with arthritis myself, I can tell you it is very frustrating to be going to one's doctor and basically be sent away with the big message being, oh, there's nothing we can do for you. And at the workshops that we run here at Arthritis Consumer Experts, that's probably the most common thing told to us by our workshop participants, is they just are left with nothing.
Well, there's the future, which is what we were talking about mm-hmm. with osteoarthritis, but there's also today. Of course, there's been tremendous surgical advances, and those are continuing. As far as non-surgical approaches, for instance, for osteoarthritis, one of the factors that are tightly linked to the development of it and to its progress is being overweight. So the increase in obesity in the population is actually increasing the number of new cases. There's a need to keep one's weight down. And the second aspect that we've learned is that good muscle tone does tremendous things to slow down and perhaps prevent the development of osteoarthritis. So being fit, not being too overweight, are probably great measures. If you develop osteoarthritis, becoming more fit and losing some of that weight is going to slow it down.
That's fascinating. And I guess one of the conundrums faced by people who perhaps have left their fitness to slip a bit is that they then have osteoarthritis and it's difficult to begin or get back to exercise because they're in pain. What does the research tell us about helping people to lose that weight, people to get fitter when they already have the disease? What are some of the things they can do to prepare for exercise?
Well, I think one of the things is to think about what sort of exercise can they do where they're not putting a lot of pressure over, say, a sore hip or a sore knee. And that means water-based exercise. The flotation that we all get just in standing in water is a huge boon to the person with arthritis, as it's a tremendous form of exercise. It's a great muscle builder, and it doesn't put nearly as much pressure over joints such as knee, hip, and back. I'd encourage people to think about that sort of exercise. There are other types of exercise, obviously, low-impact aerobics and things that may not put as much weight across that are preferable to perhaps something like jogging, where you are going to be putting very high pressures over your lower extremity joints.
Right, thanks. If we're to think about research developments in areas other than in osteoarthritis, I suppose we sort of, if you're working or volunteering in arthritis, we think about inflammatory arthritis, and there's some sort of big headliners, if you will, in that general category, being rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and ankylosing spondylitis. as well as with lupus, which a lot of people at the public level don't know is arthritis. So maybe starting with rheumatoid arthritis, can you tell us what some of the more recent advances have been in the area of let's say what it is, just breaking it down very simply? Do we know? Are we any closer to finding out the answer of what it is?
Well, Cheryl, you mentioned rheumatoid arthritis, the psoriatic and ankylosing spondylitis, which are two other types of arthritis, and lupus. One thing that they all share is that they're inflammatory and that the inflammation may be, in all of them, immune-driven. Certainly, immune abnormalities play a huge role in rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. The specifics of the individual diseases, of course, do differ, but there has been a tremendous advance in our ability to improve the lot of everyone with inflammatory arthritis. All of those conditions were 30 years ago very poorly, if at all, treatable, and that is not the case today.
What are some of the big advances in your mind then in the treatment of those types of inflammatory arthritis? When you say significant advances have been made, in a nutshell, can you sum them up for us?
Across the board, starting really, I think, with rheumatoid arthritis and lupus, but involving the others, there's now excellent evidence that a key element that has altered outcome is early intervention. So instead of, as was done 30 years ago, perhaps spending a year and telling doctors not to worry about not making a speedy diagnosis, we now say that for conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, you need to make the diagnosis within weeks. You need to start treatment aggressively. That may mean multiple drugs given at the same time to arrest the arthritis and prevent the horrendous damage and toll of disability, pain, loss of job that was the inevitable consequence of rheumatoid arthritis in the past. The same need for early intervention has altered the outcomes for conditions like lupus, and I'm sure we're going to be getting data very soon that this applies to psoriatic arthritis and spondylitis as well.
Wow, so the early diagnosis, timely, it sounds like these are medical emergencies.
They're certainly medical urgencies, and that where perhaps even 5 years ago, a primary care physician or family doctor could get away with not being really on top of these conditions, that's no longer true.
Right. Is it easy for them to make the diagnosis early so that a person can get started on timely treatment?
The difficulty has been a lack of teaching in medical school. So where medical students may receive hundreds of hours on how to listen to a heart, they may only receive a few hours on how to examine the more than 100 joints in the body.
That's amazing, given, again, the prevalence.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So number one in your mind, obviously, is that timely, the realization that we need timely diagnosis of these kinds of diseases. What else?
Let's take lupus, and this applies to rheumatoid arthritis and probably to the other inflammatory conditions. Lupus, 30 years ago again, half of the people with lupus were dead within 5 years, a staggering mortality rate. It's now thought that perhaps lupus should be living just as long. People with lupus diagnosed today should live as long as someone without lupus, or very close to that, dramatically different. What we've realized, however, is that they are dying of heart attacks. Now, lupus affects young women. You never see a heart attack in a young woman. It just doesn't happen. If you do, you have to think of a condition like lupus. The ability to stop people from dying from lupus has brought out the fact that autoimmune diseases can affect the blood vessels and heart and cause heart attacks and strokes. So one area of research that has immediate implications is that we need to be much more aggressive in treating the risk factors for heart disease, like high blood pressure, high blood sugar, which is diabetes, high cholesterol, very aggressively in people with lupus, as well as people with the other inflammatory types of arthritis.
That's amazing.
Finally, I think one of the big things that has really altered the way we think about these diseases has been the explosion of understanding about immune abnormalities and inflammation. Basic scientists working over two decades have described a cascade of small molecules that are signals to cells, inflammatory cells, to rev them up, shut them down, make them attack tissue, and so on. These inflammatory types of arthritis are conditions where the body's own cells are attacking the joints and other tissues of the body and leading to the damage and the disability, and in the past, premature death. Knowing about these inflammatory molecules, which has taken huge research efforts, has led to the development of a variety of medications and proteins that obliterate or severely curtail the excess inflammation. Probably, although we have seen several new classes of drugs developed over the last few years and become available in Canada and the U.S., there's going to be further advance in the next decade. Nonetheless, what we've seen already with these biological drugs or agents that target the small molecules, the inflammatory molecules, has been very, very impressive. We've seen now three drugs that are available in Canada to target a little molecule called anti-TNF. It sounds very friendly, but it's incredibly damaging. And the ability to interfere with that molecule has made it possible in the most severe types of rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and ankylosing spondylitis to shut the arthritis down in about half the people who get it.
That's amazing. These discoveries, I mean, they're not, are we, will they happen faster now? Once you're on the trail of a bad actor, so to speak, is it going to happen faster? Are we going to get to the cure more quickly because we now have a sort of a hint, if you will, of what's happening within the body's immune system?
Discovering these agents, developing them, testing them, and showing that they work, the estimate is that to produce one will cost $1 billion, so that many, perhaps hundreds, are tested at one point or another to end up with one that is sufficiently safe and beneficial that it's actually allowed by regulatory agencies in the United States, Canada, Europe, and so on, to be given to patients. So part of it has been the ability of companies to see that there is a market, and that's been a shift. I think industry has realized arthritis is a huge problem and that someone who solves it is going to be rewarded for doing so.
Mm. In terms of research developments in the area of gene studies, you talked about genetic profiling. I think people that come from the public to our workshops, you know, they really are searching for an answer to their question, what is it? Why me? Why did I get rheumatoid arthritis? Is it because, you know, my mom had a bent finger? Is it, you know, did I get this from someone in my family? Can you maybe just shed some light on that question?
Genes are complicated, and the benefit that we get from them, understanding about genetics, may be somewhat different than you suggest. Certainly, the genes are linked to inflammatory arthritis. They're linked very closely to spondylitis. There is no disease in the world that is tightly linked to a gene as ankylosing spondylitis. We've known about that gene for 30 years, but knowing that a gene is linked doesn't tell you that it's actually that gene. It doesn't tell you, if you don't know what the gene is responsible for doing, what aspect of what that gene does that's relevant to the disease. And of course, it doesn't tell you how to stop that aspect of what that gene does. Rheumatoid arthritis is not a single gene. It's probably multiple genes. So where spondylitis is difficult, rheumatoid arthritis is an enigma. It's going to be very difficult to crack affecting the genes in a way that's going to improve therapy. It's not that people haven't tried, but I think the answer may not be immediate. One area where genes may prove helpful, and again, it's really not here yet, is in guiding therapy. It's possible that by knowing more about the genetic makeup of people, we'll understand why some people respond to one drug and not another, and vice versa. So there is a lot of hope that perhaps better study of genetics and proteins in the blood will help us to understand who should be treated with what.
So that's sort of like gene profiling, if you will.
It is.
Yeah. And how far along are we in that scope of work? Are we just starting?
That's very early.
Yeah.
I think this is, since the Human Genome Project has basically been able to tell the world what every gene is, it's going to be much more possible to look at individuals, scan their genes, and see, are the differences between this group who did so well and this other group who didn't do so well.
In just a last follow-up question around genes, particularly in inflammatory arthritis, does each you said that it would be possibly, it's a set of genes, it's a, you know, more than one or multiple genes that are involved. Is it the same set of genes or multiple genes from person to person, or does that change as well?
In spondylitis, we know about really one little area of genes that seem to be somehow related to getting it. The chance, if you have that gene, is about 100 times higher than if you don't, of getting the spondylitis. In rheumatoid arthritis, we also know about genes close by, but not the identical area, that are important and relate to autoimmune disease itself. But it appears that that alone is not enough. Whether you need 5 genes or 3 genes or some combination of them, and then an interaction with some other event, perhaps a virus, a mild infection, something really inconsequential to most people.
So an environmental trigger, in other
words. There may well be an environmental trigger that in the right setting can set this off.
Hmm. So still a lot of unanswered questions out there for people who are perhaps living with it today or have a family member living with it and are trying to mitigate against getting it themselves.
Absolutely. I think that's why we feel in Canada that arthritis research should span that spectrum from very basic research where you're really trying to understand processes where the payoff may not be for 2 decades for people with arthritis, through to things that are going to help people next week and are going to help governments next week know how to best serve people with arthritis.
Right. In wrapping up our discussion, tell us how people with arthritis are involved in arthritis research today in Canada. Are they playing a role? Are they working with researchers to help guide what's happening in the research development process?
Well, Cheryl, I think no one could answer that question better than you, in fact. But Canada is a leader in involving people with arthritis in the research project. The Canadian Arthritis Network, that group of Canadian scientists interested in arthritis research that I mentioned earlier, has really done something unique in the world They have created a consumer advisory council, which you were the first chairperson and involved in building from the very beginning. This group is involved in assessing all of the research projects, adjudicating them, adjudicating those applying to become arthritis researchers, intimately involved in the research projects themselves. This is unique in Canada and was commended recently in a review of the network by the federal government as an outstanding international achievement. There is a huge role for the consumer in arthritis research, and Canada is leading in it. Certainly people who want to know more can become involved through your organization, Arthritis Consumer Experts, through the Arthritis Society's Patients Group, Canadian Arthritis Patient Alliance, or through the Canadian Arthritis Network. All have website access and certainly can involve a consumer in a way that may be of interest to them.
I think we've seen great advances, and I know that there are a lot of people out there who would like to get involved in participating in health research decision making. And I think it's really important that at your research center, the Arthritis Research Center of Canada, you also have now, I understand, created a consumer advisory board. And these individuals, I imagine, are being very, very active in the research planning phase.
I can assure you that the Consumer Advisory Board at my Arthritis Research Center is very powerful, and we take a lot of valuable advice from them. They're very involved in our research projects, in trying to set research priorities of what's important for people with arthritis, and helping us as scientists understand that. And certainly that's a group that in British Columbia would be a great group to contact through the Arthritis Research Center.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today, Dr. Esdaile. It's been really illuminating, and we're very thankful that you've offered us your time and expertise.
Thank you for having me, Cheryl.
You're welcome. We hope you'll come back.
I would appreciate it and enjoy it.
And thanks to you, our Joint Health Podcast audience, for listening. As with all of ACE's programs and services, please keep in mind that the information provided in Joint Health Podcasts is not medical advice, and ACE does not brand or promote any product or company. The information provided is to help you better understand arthritis and help you talk to your own rheumatologist or healthcare provider to make the best treatment decisions for yourself. Again, thank you for listening.